There is nothing you can do to sully that godly soul. It remains infinitely connected. It's perhaps a diamond in the mud, but it still remains a diamond. And you are worthy of love and connection despite your misdeeds. And at the highest level, your misdeeds become this opportunity for tremendous growth.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the BEM Podcast. This morning, I had the pleasure of spending some time with Rabbi Mordechai Berg from Yeshivat Mivaseret. Berg is somebody that I look up to tremendously through the years of seeing him just give his shiurim and kind of how he handles himself in the world of chinuch and the NCSY world and Yeshivat Mivaseret as a whole. And there's just so much to learn from him. And today's topic that we spoke about and we got really in-depth in, as I like to say, in the idea of being vulnerable during your year in yeshiva and seminary. This is something that Berg has a lot to share, especially because he's done a lot of amazing work on, you know, this Indian in Mivaseret with the guys that are there. So without further ado, I'm super excited for you guys to hear what we spoke about. And last but not least, quick shout out to the sponsor of today's video, and that is Noble Custom Suits. You're going to hear a little bit about them halfway through this episode. Without further ado, it's time to listen to my conversation with Rabbi Mordechai Berg. Welcome to the Israel Gap Year Be'in Podcast. I'm your host, Avi Proctor, and in each episode, we get Be'in in depth into the remarkable lives of individuals in Israel who dedicate themselves to inspiring the next generation of Klal Yisrael. Welcome, Rav Berg. Thank you so much for coming 5 minutes all the way from your house in Beit Shemir.
Very beautiful over here. Thank you very much.
Baruch Hashem, I like it too. So today's topic, as you know, we were discussing before, is about embracing vulnerability during your year in yeshiva and seminary, and there's so many things with that. But before I want to talk about that, kind of give me a little bit of a background to yourself and how we got here today, and bring me to that.
Okay, great to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I grew up in the Five Towns. Went to a bunch of different yeshivas. I was in Hafter until fifth grade. And then, we'll keep it clean, I journeyed from Hafter to a place called Yeshiva Darche Torah, which is a very different move. So one is a co-ed modern Orthodox school, the other was a black hat yeshivish school. I feel very blessed to have had the opportunity to learn in both of those very incredible institutions. I got very close with Rabbi Bender and Darche. Baruch Hashem, I still have a kesher with him today. And then Rambam for 4 years, made it through all 4 years. So that was, that was very special. Great crew, great chevra. And then I went to Mivaseret actually. And where I now work. And actually initially I didn't get into Mivaseret. I was initially waitlisted from Mivaseret, but I had a second interview and I was able to get my way in on the second interview. I spent a year and a half in Mivaseret and I bounced around for about 6 months. I didn't find the right yeshiva for myself. And then Rav Parnas announced that he was leaving YU to go to Landers, to start Landers. And so I spent the next 8 years learning by Rav Parnas. That was a very special privilege. I had the opportunity to learn with him Bechavrusa for a couple of years. That really shaped a lot of my learning, a lot of my worldview. That's my Rebbe. And then back to Mivaseret, we made Aliyah. We're in our 16th year now. We moved also here to Beit Shemesh. When we first moved in, there were sheep in my backyard grazing every day. Now there are malls and cities where those sheep used to be. Kanai Nahara, blessed to be married with 6 children and a grandchild now.
And nice WhatsApp profile picture, by the way.
Yes, thank you. That's he was crying, and it was like the sweetest cry because he was so sad. So I captured that. That's my WhatsApp profile now. And it gets mixed reviews. Some people like it, some people don't. I love it. And then, yeah, that brings us to today. Been in Mivaseret for the last 16 years.
So I can't help but think, but like being a Talmud in the yeshiva, and first of all, as you said, getting waitlisted, and then end up becoming one of the heads of the yeshiva, did you ever think that that's where you would end up? And like, how geschmack is that for you today?
That was actually what I dreamed. One of the, I guess it's an episode about vulnerability, so probably should lead by example. In high school, if you asked me what did I want to do for a living, so I would lie, because nobody wants to say they want to be a teacher, because then you'll get beat up. So, but I really, like in my heart, I thought it would be cool to be a teacher. Like my mom's a teacher, and I always thought that that was an awesome thing that she did with her life. My dad was very successful in advertising, so I would tell people, yeah, I'll probably go into advertising, some more business, maybe be a lawyer, you know. And then when I came to Mevaseret, part of my process was saying, okay, so I'm actually going to do this. I'm going to tell people that I want to be a teacher. And originally, like, I had a really great literature teacher. His name was Dr. Horowitz, passed away. And he just really made it like come alive, and he was really passionate about it. So I thought like maybe I could be like a great literature teacher and really get the guys into it. And then when I started to enjoy learning, I said it would be that'd be a cool thing to do if like I could be a Rebbe. And I had this dream when I was 18, like how crazy would it be if I could come back to Eretz Yisrael and actually teach in Eretz Yisrael. But I thought nobody would ever hire me. I actually did my master's degree in special education because I thought maybe the only way somebody would give me a job is if I was like teaching like those kids that had like different, you know, learning capacities. And in the end, Baruch Hashem, I went a different direction. But that was my initial foray into this dream of teaching in Eretz Yisrael. In fact, when I was dating my wife, she asked me if I wanted to live in Eretz Yisrael because that was really important to her. And I said, yes, but it's more important to me to teach. So if I can't teach in Eretz Yisrael, I'd rather be a Rebbe in America than, you know, be a businessman in Eretz Yisrael. And she was on board for that. And then when we were making Aliyah, so I had these opportunities here in Eretz Yisrael, and out of the blue, I don't know if I'm allowed to say which one, but there was a yeshiva high school in America that offered me to be the menahal of their yeshiva, and so I didn't know what to do. And I went to different rebbeim, but ultimately my wife called me out on it, and she said, you said that if you had the opportunity to be a Rebbe in Eretz Yisrael, you would take it. And we have this opportunity, even though the opportunity in America ostensibly was much greater. I kept my word, and we made Aliyah. Sometimes boys say to me, Rebbe, when did you know you wanted to make Aliyah? And my wife goes, yeah, have you figured that out yet? Like, do you know that you want to make Aliyah yet? But I do know now. It's a wonderful life, yeah.
Wow. So, you know, on the topic of being in yeshiva and kind of building your way up there and really having that geschmack for teaching, at what point were you like, you know, in the world of chinuch that you were, and you're like, I really am passionate about this idea of being vulnerable, and kind of take me through what you've been able to start doing with Talmidim and yeshiva.
I don't know if I can pinpoint like an exact time, but it's probably a reflection of my own journey. I don't think I'm alone in this, but I think a lot of us feel like we're faking our way through life. I definitely felt that way in elementary school and high school. Even my year in Israel, I definitely felt there was like an element of like this thing that I'm like that I should be. And I spent a lot of time trying to be that person for other people. Including Frumkeit, not just like being like a cool, you know, like a high school kid. It was also really important to me, you know, I was coming into Eretz Yisrael and you have to do like the flip out thing. Like that was definitely like a part of like what I had in my head. And there was definitely a significant part of my journey early on where I was like pushing myself to be somebody that I wasn't because that's what I thought I had to be. And so then you're living with this duality of like knowing that you're a faker. Right, so like on the outside you're from, and there's this word like he's doing well. Like does anyone know what that word actually means? You know, what I'm talking about? Like he's doing well in his year in Israel. Like what does that mean? Like he's doing well. So I was officially doing well, but definitely on the inside there was a part of me that felt fake about it. In fact, there's a Rebbe who's now a Rebbe in Mevaseret. At the time he was a kolal guy in Mevaseret, and he's a real, real tzaddik. And he's like one of these like very gentle people, and I'm not a gentle person. That's not my nature. But I thought that to be frum meant that I had to be like this edel-madel, very gentle, you know, like hold your hands like this and speak in very low tones and like develop some sort of hunch. You know, that's what I was like trying to do. And this one Rebbe noticed and he's like, you're not him. I was like, but I'm supposed to be, right? And he's like, no, like that's the craziest thing. And he really gave it to me. I don't know if I heard, I mean, I definitely heard it, but I don't know if I heard it. It took time to realize that discovering the contours of our own being and coming into that, I think is the most important part of becoming as a human being, as an adult, as a Jew. So I don't know if I could pinpoint an exact time, but I think that's so much of what we're obligated to give over to these, you know, very young men and women. And I think at 18, you know, they, if you remember what it was like to be 18 is...
It's only a few years ago for me, yeah, but...
I'm 43 now. 18 is very young. It's the oldest they've ever been, you know, and it's this, like, rite of passage. I'm not in high school anymore, but 18 is very young. And I think we do have an obligation to say to them that whatever it is they're going through, it's okay and it's understandable. And whatever it is that they're going through is part of this process of becoming, and sort of just give them permission and space to do that. And, you know, we're threading the needle between two very hard things here, because Judaism has rules and regulations like in any relationship. And so there are things, because we're in a relationship with Hashem, there are things that we are obligated to do and things that we're not allowed to do. And also, we're human and we're imperfect by definition, and it's not always going to be pretty. In fact, it's more often going to be messy and awkward and imperfect. And I think that that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted perfection, he had Malachim, he had himself. Clearly, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants imperfection, he creates us. So, really making it about yeshivas and seminaries, about a place where kids can be themselves and make mistakes and also, you know, get called out for those mistakes, right? And it's not like we can just say, like, hey, make every mistake you want. That's not great chinuch either. But threading that needle between striving for something great, but knowing that it's messy and it's awkward, that's sort of the, you know, crossroads that we're living in, I think, these days.
So I'm very curious, do you have any advice potentially for somebody who might be listening to this that is in yeshiva and seminary about, from your experience of seeing and speaking with kids, of like seeing how vulnerable people are during their year and the importance of that, but like advice of like, it is okay to struggle, or do you have any, you know, thing to kind of say on that a little bit for any students that might be going through ups and downs in their year?
Well, first of all, I mean, I don't know if it's a piece of advice, but it is okay to struggle. Like, I think,
yeah, of course.
I think sometimes as Rebbeim, I think what we do is we pretend that we're perfect. And so the Talmidim think that we are, and then they think that they have to be. One of my favorite days ever in yeshiva was a young man. We went on a walk together, and he burst out crying. And he had this tremendous story to share of his own failure, that he had eaten not kosher when he was in high school. And, you know, there's levels of not kosher, right? There's like the, you know, the chewing gum, you know, like, and then there's like Burger King. So he had eaten Burger King. Okay. And by the way, a kid, a great kid from a great family, from a great yeshiva, the last kid in the world that you think would have eaten Burger King, but he did. But it was interesting. His pain point was that he'll never be able to be a Rebbe. And he had this also this secret dream of one day being a Rebbe. But he actually went to a yeshiva high school where the Rebbeim are exceptionally impressive and very high-level people. And he said, my Rebbeim don't do Averus. And they didn't do Averus when they were in high school either. And I was like, yeah, they did. They did do Averus then. And I'm betting they even do Averus now because they're not perfect. And today he is in Chinuch, that young man. And I'll never forget that conversation because I realized how important it was. We don't realize how much our Talmidim are paying attention to us. So if somebody came to me and they were struggling, I would say, welcome to the club. You know, you think that just because you're 18, you look at a Rebbe who's maybe been doing it for a while longer. We're just older, you know, and maybe there are certain things that we've leveled out of, but there are new things that we've leveled into, so new struggles. And I think that our educational model, again, I don't know if it's a piece of advice, but we have to communicate to these kids that struggle is part of the process. You know, I'll give you an example of this. This is less dramatic example, but I think it's important. How many young men come to yeshiva and Eretz Yisrael for the year, open up a Gemara, and then they get frustrated right away and they go, I don't know what it's saying. I can't read it. I can't translate it. I can't punctuate it. I can't vowelize it. I'm missing the background information. I've never been trained to understand a dialectic. I've never learned Brisker Lumdus before. I don't understand, even if I do know all the words of the Gemara, I'm not sure that I could follow the back and forth because there's holes in the Gemara. That's where the Rishonim fill it in. Right? It doesn't appear to be very relevant to my life, but they get very frustrated. I can't do this, and they close the sefer. You're not supposed to know how to do it. If you knew how to do it, you wouldn't come to yeshiva. Right? So it's like somehow we've communicated to these kids, you're supposed to know how to do this. You're not supposed to know how to do this. If you knew how to do it, you wouldn't be by us. So when we talk about struggling, what do we really mean? Like, I'm not good at this yet. Okay. So what? Like, what's the problem with that? You're not supposed to be good at this. So I guess if someone came to me and asked me for a piece of advice, I would say maybe the first thing is, this is like understandable. It's normal. It's expected. I'm not sure what else you'd be looking for. You'd be looking to be great at it day one. I mean, that's not the way anything in life works. You're going to go into business. You're not going to be great at it day one. You're going to make mistakes. The other thing I would say is, it's really about the journey, not about the results. I think the people who stick with the struggle and they stay in it and they're able to embrace their own imperfections, they're learning so much just from the journey. I don't know if we ever arrive. I don't know if there's a place called completion in this world. And I think, you know, it's like a horizon that you never reach, but you keep sailing towards it. And in the process of sailing towards it, so many things change. So let's say, for example, how many years are you married now? You guys, how many years are you married?
About two. Almost 2 years, Baruch
Hashem. Right? So, you know, the beginning of marriage looks very different than, you know, I'm married now almost 22 years. The beginning of marriage, you know, is very different than 22 years in, and I imagine that 42 years in will look different than 22 years in. But if I asked you, what have you learned so far in your first 2 years, I imagine you guys have learned volumes. And that's beautiful. That's what it's expected to be. Imagine somebody came in on day one of their marriage and said, I got this. I think that would be so sad. Like, what are you going to do now? You just, like, you're perfect together? I remember once there was a certain Rebbe who was Masada Kedushin. He was a very funny person. He was Masada Kedushin at a wedding where I was an aide under the chuppah. It was a dear friend of mine. And he was this real tzaddik of a guy. And he married this real tzaddikus, you know, like two people, like, and this Rebbe under the chuppah looked at me and he goes, and like into the mic, like everyone heard it. He goes, how much does it annoy you to know that these two will never fight? They'll never struggle with their shalom bias. And everyone burst out laughing. And I said to him, like, very gently under the chuppah, I was like, this might not be the best time to have that conversation. But the truth is, I don't think he was right. I'm betting that they also had their shalom bias struggles, even though they're two wonderful people. Learning to live together is hard, but we learn so much and we become so much along the way. So I wouldn't want to be good at it. If I was good at it, how would I ever become? Does that make sense?
Of course. And, you know, you talked a little bit about the journey a second ago, that, you know, everything is about a journey per se. So talk a little bit about that journey that you take students through a little bit in yeshiva, and how you cultivate an environment essentially where they're like, I come into yeshiva and maybe I'm not so comfortable or so used to being vulnerable in somewhat of a public setting or even a private setting. So kind of how do you get kids to that step of, like, at least step one, maybe, of like opening up and being vulnerable in yeshiva?
I think we do have to recognize, in a general sense, our community is amazing, and Baruch Hashem, we do a lot of amazing things. And I'm not sure that this is unique to our community. I think a lot of the kids coming in have been trained not necessarily to be authentic. It's a very competitive world within the Jewish world. Right. And those who have not, you know, are you Yeshiva League? Are you out of town? You know, it's hard. It's a hard system these kids are coming in from. So I think day one, we have to recognize that we're coming in from behind the eight ball. Because when the community is so competitive, and again, I don't want to say chas v'shalom anything bad. I don't mean to say that the community is only competitive. We're also a community of tremendous chesed and tremendous limud haTorah and tefillah and communal infrastructure. There's a tremendous amount of amazing things about the community. And one area, perhaps, where we could expand a little bit is to be a little bit less, how do I say this nicely? A little bit less boxy, maybe. A little bit more open. And there's, again, I think it's not unique to 18-year-olds. You see it sometimes with the guys in their 30s and their 40s and their 50s. They're still the same. Sometimes I look back and I go, like, wow, it's still the same competitive atmosphere that it was when I was 16. Like, that's pretty crazy. You know, like, who has that car, that house, that job? Who's made it? Who's getting honored? So I think we have to recognize that it's our responsibility to create an environment where there's a level of, like, a high level of safety. Because in all things, chinuch, safety first. Right? Nobody's going to do something if they're deeply uncomfortable. So, you know, it's the environment that you create in the yeshiva, the Shana Bet guys, let's say, leading the way because they've been through it. In Rebbeim's offices, you know, giving guys permission to talk about their struggles, recognizing that chinuch today doesn't only mean the limud Torah. It's just as much, I think, we've taken the Musar movement in a certain sense to its farthest point, right? It's not just about learning that particular sefer, but it's learning the person. It's really trying to understand the mensch. And I think one thing I will say is I find that the kids today are exceptional. I think it's a dor mitzuyon. I think people talk about Yerida Sadoros. I don't know what they're talking about. I think the kids are amazing. I think they have a different set of challenges than we had perhaps in the 90s and even in the early 2000s. But I think they're incredible. I think their openness to discovering themselves and to talking about their struggles, I think, is way ahead of what I would have done as a kid. So we can create an environment of safety just by authentically having real kindness and compassion for the Talmidim, because everything is understandable even if we don't understand it yet. Like, every single thing we do is understandable. The kid who's struggling in yeshiva or with his own personal growth or with different areas of Yiddishkeit, if you would actually know what we went through and why we're behaving that way, we're understandable. Anything that's understandable is forgivable. So if a guy walks into a Rebbe's office and he's genuinely looked at with compassion, with kindness, because he is understandable, of course he's going to open up. They want to, by the way. I find that kids want to unburden themselves because they're holding a very heavy knapsack. And they're walking hunched over, and they want to let go of that knapsack. And it's really hard to let go, especially if that knapsack has been protecting you for so long. So I think if we do that, you'll see very quickly, they'll flock. They'll be like, okay, so like, yeah, I got to talk about this, you know?
You know, getting kids to kind of, as you just said, unload on that knapsack, that, of course, is a process, right? So through that process of getting kids to really open up and unload and be vulnerable, what would you say are some of those humps that kids, that you've, is a common hump? It could be a general claw or specific things we've seen with kids of like, that is why that kid is not, you know, able to open up or kind of essentially get that backpack off their back.
I think it's the same for everybody, but I don't think it's just about the kids. I think I do it too. I think all the adults I know do it. Every single person in the world struggles with shame. You know, shame is the mother of all exiles. So it's this fundamental belief that I'm unworthy of love and connection because of what I've done. And in Judaism, if we're being honest, right, we don't really want you to experience that type of shame. What we'd like is healthy guilt and regret. The Rambam talks about regret as part of your tshuva process. Regret, adults can regret things because they learn from it, right? So it's like, that wasn't my best self. But you can only do that if you know that your actions don't define you. I once heard from Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Twersky, he said, healthy guilt is like the bumps on the side of the highway. It just gently reminds you to, you know, move your car over a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much the case in yeshiva. If a guy is going to come in and unburden himself and he's about to tell a Rebbe, I did this, right? I ate Burger King or whatever the equivalent of that is that the guys are and the girls are struggling with today. So then they have to believe that they are a godly soul. Elokai neshama shenasata b'tahorihi. There is nothing you can do to sully that godly soul. It remains infinitely connected. It's perhaps a diamond in the mud, but it still remains a diamond. And you are worthy of love and connection despite your misdeeds. And at the highest level, your misdeeds become this opportunity for tremendous growth. So it's really hard to walk into a Rebbe's office and say, I did X, if that makes me unworthy of love and connection. I think that would be my first answer. My second answer would be, it's really hard to let go of those things because they're protectors. Like, let's say, for example, laziness, right? Like, it's very easy for a guy in yeshiva, you know, Rebbe go, oh, he's lazy, you know. But laziness is also a coping mechanism. Like, why is he lazy, right? Like, what's going on that he's lazy? Well, I'm just making something up. Let's say his laziness protects him from failure, right? Because if I don't try, then I don't fail. And let's say for him, failure means he's unworthy of love and connection. So he's not lazy, he's protective, right? It's a different way of looking at it. So that guy who just can't get up in the morning, well, some of it maybe is because he's going to sleep at ridiculous hours, but then you'd also have to ask yourself the question, why is he going to sleep at ridiculous hours? So these things, they're perhaps parts that are having negative impact, but they're also having positive impact. So we're asking people to really take a good hard look at themselves and say, like, this thing that you're doing that's having this negative impact, can that part of you sit somewhere else in the car, right? It doesn't need to sit in the driver's seat. That's a tremendous amount of work that we're asking an 18-year-old to do who's never done it before and doesn't know how to do it. You know what I mean? So I think the barriers to entry are, first of all, we have to let people know that you are worthy of love and connection, even though you may not have done things that you're particularly proud of. And two, the thing that you did was protecting you. It wasn't, I'm not saying it was the best thing. It certainly had negative impact, but there are no bad parts, and you were acting out for a reason, right? So it's giving it that context.
Well, we will be right back to today's episode with Rabbi Mordechai Berg, but first I want to give a shout out to the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Noble Custom Suits. Are you somebody that values your time? If so, this is the perfect business for you. And perfect place for you to get a suit for yourself. Noble Custom Suits was founded by myself alongside my partner Aaron Tuckman in America with the idea of putting the customer before anything to help show you how valuable your time is. We come to your house, we sit down with you for about an hour, we measure you, and we build a custom suit from scratch. And it's a process that so many people enjoy. And hopefully you're gonna enjoy that as well. So if you're interested to learn more about Noble Custom Suits and to receive a special offer, go to www.noblecustomsuits.com to find more. And now it's time to get right back to today's episode with Rabbi Mordechai Berg. Context. You know, speaking about the process that these kids go through, I can't help but think about, like, you know, when a kid comes in, they want yeshiva. Of course, most kids are probably not in that stage where they're comfortable really opening up and really making that those meaningful connections with the Rebbe to, you know, eventually lead to something special. But in your opinion, the way I would phrase it is, like, do you ever give up on a kid, or do you ever say, you know what, I've worked on this kid for 4.5 months to try to get him to open up. I tried so many different methods and it's just not going anywhere. And then you say, like, I'm going to step back a little bit. Like, do you ever have those types of situations? And do you think you could ever give up in that regard on a kid?
I would just maybe reframe the premise a little bit, because I don't know that it's our job to open them up. And I think that that could also be a mistake. First of all, I think it's important for a Rebbeim to have healthy boundaries. And in general, I think all people, certainly 18-year-olds, to try to pressure them to open up, I'm not sure that that's a good thing. First of all, we're not going to be the ones to deal with the negative impact of them opening up, right? Because when you start to do this work and things shift, so you don't necessarily see it coming, right? But you might move, like, think about ourselves as, like, remember those, like, little games where you, like, have to, like, move, like, there's only one piece of the puzzle missing and you have to, like, move them all together, right? Once you start to shift things, you don't know how other things are going to shift, right? So let's say, for example, that kid who's lazy because he's protecting himself from failure. So now you've given him this, like, come on, man, you got to, like, deal with this, right? Well, what if he starts to really unpack, like, where does that feel or fear of failure come from? And now he starts to look at his family of origin, his community, his Rebbeim, right? There might be some fallout there, which is okay, but that has to be his choice. So I don't know that we're working on people to open them up. We're creating the opportunity for people to do what they want with it. And I think it's okay for them to go at their pace, which I think really is the part that answers your question. If after 4.5 months they haven't opened up, that's okay. If it's not okay, then we fail to create the safety, right? Because they have to go at their pace. And I would finish just by saying how important the midah of patience is as a Rebbe. Because, you know, you could write a kid off after 4.5 months, but why? Like, we're invested in the Jewish community. We're invested in our people, literally from the day that they're born until the day that they're die, you know, that they pass away. So, like, you know, there's a rabbi of a shul, hopefully, that they're going to when they're in their 40s and 50s and 60s that's still working with them. So why would we write somebody off after 4.5 months at the age of 18? Like, that's not what we do, right? We work with them for this age, and then we pass them on to the next stage of the Jewish community and the next stage of the Jewish community. We never give up on anyone. So, Yeah, I don't know why we would write them off after 4.5 months. I probably think, if I'm being honest with you, it's okay for Rebbeim to have those feelings of frustration because we're human beings. But I would then, probably if it was me, I would want to challenge myself and go, okay, what ego is coming up for you, right? Because you had this need for him to do something that he didn't do. That's much more about us than it is about the kids.
You know, two things you just said that I kind of want to touch on is that the first thing is it's not the Rebbe's job to open a kid up, right? And it's like a tough balance, and you got to be very aware of how you're doing it and you know, trust the process and have patience. But from doing this for so long, you must have many talmidim that come in front of your face and you're like, this kid could really use that opening up, essentially, and then he doesn't. So yes, it's not your job to open them up, but like, how do you find that balance? Because you're also a human being who's trying to help people, and you're like, this kid really needs the help, but he's not getting there. So it's like, yes, you have the patience, but as also another human being that is helping human beings, how do you balance out of this kid really needs my help, but he's not really called taking it, essentially?
Well, I think you're right, and I think you're hitting on a sensitive topic here, because there's no doubt that it's a Rebbe's job to challenge the talmidim. And so again, we're threading the needle, right? This dialectical tension between challenging them and creating safety. And it's not an easy nexus to live at, because how do you do that, right? So we might say a hard thing to them and we might challenge them. I once heard, Aseh l'charav and k'nei l'chachaver. Aseh l'charav means you have a Rebbe who's challenging you, so you better go buy a friend because you're going to need a support system. I think today the Rebbe is playing a very dual role of Aseh l'charav and k'nei l'chachaver, where the Rebbe is also that support system. So you're right. Our job is to challenge them. But there's a thin line here where challenge becomes control. And control is like, that's the thing we have to make sure to stay away from, because it's their journey, right? So I can challenge them and maybe say a hard thing and maybe go, it seems like you could use some help in this area. Would you be willing to explore that? You know, I could say to them, this doesn't seem to be working well for you, right? And you could say it in a sensitive and gentle way. And there's no doubt that we're meant to challenge them. But then at the end of the day, it's not the Rebbe's responsibility to live their life. And it's okay if they make choices that are not the choices you would make. And even if those choices have negative impact, that's also okay, because that's their process of learning. You know, like, my grandmother became a balas tshuva at 70 years old. So what does that mean? That means the first 70 years of her life were a waste? No, those were her years of becoming until she was, you know, arriving at that point. You know, Rav Akiva, you know, until 40 years old. So I'm saying, like, I don't know. I'm sure there were many people along the way, you know, Rebbeim of Reish Lakish that got upset at Reish Lakish that he wasn't behaving appropriately. And in the end, he became Reish Lakish. Not every story has a storybook ending, but I do think that it's okay for people to be in process. I think that even if they make choices that are not the choices we would want them to make, maybe they're even choices that are antithetical to Torah. Okay, but we care about people, right? So it's... if we genuinely care about people, so then we'll give them that runway.
You know, you mentioned a second ago about, you know, Aseh l'charav and k'nei l'chachaver. I think sometimes when it comes to the Rebbe-Talmud relationship, and shout out to Rabbi Glantz, because we spoke about this in his episode, it's a hard balance sometimes of when you are someone that is making such an impact on these kids, you have very deep, meaningful conversations about some of the most private things that very few people in the world also know. So how do you find that balance, you personally, I guess you could say, of... these kids are really vulnerable to me. They're really opening up about super interesting or sensitive topics. But then you also have, call it that friend aspect, where you have them over for a Shabbos sim and stuff like that. Like, how do you draw that balance for yourself?
There's a Talmud who I love very, very dearly. He was my first year ever of teaching. And he always, like, because we've been so close for so long, so he always says, like, I just have trouble with, like, what you are. You're like my friend, or you're like my Rebbe, you know. And I started teaching when I was much younger, so we were actually much closer in age. The Talmidim now, it's a little bit easier. I'm significantly older than them. And my wife said to him, he came over to the house once, and my wife said to him, you don't want him to be your friend. You have plenty of friends, but you don't have that many Rebbeim. I do think that a Rebbe who becomes a friend, we've lost something, because then that's not your Rebbe anymore. A friend challenges you, I think, in a very different way. So I do think that we have to be Rebbeim first. And that means role models, and it means, you know, holding ourselves accountable to a high standard so that they can look up to us. Also recognizing that we're allowed to be imperfect. But I do think that there should be a healthy distance. This was actually a topic of conversation between Rav Herschel and I on NCSY Kollel. They did this past summer, an open debate between different Rebbeim and different topics. It was fascinating. And the topic that Rav Herschel and I were given was, should a Rebbe know what a young man is doing on a Matzah Shabbos? I'm cleaning it up because I think they said Saturday night. And it was a fascinating conversation because Rav Herschel was taking the position, of course your Rebbe should know because you want your Rebbe involved in your life. I had to take the harder position, which is not a position that I 100% agree with, but that there's value in having the distance between a Rebbe and a Talmud. Probably somewhere in between those things is where the truth is. But I do think that our guys lose out when they're pals with their Rebbeim, when they're buddies with their Rebbeim, if they like slap them on the back and go, yo, Rabbi, what's going on? I think they lose out because that's not a Rebbe that they look up to. I think when I was younger, the Rebbeim were older and more distant, and then there was a course correction where the Rebbeim became much younger and much more relevant. And I think now we're sort of back in the middle of those two things, partially because those younger Rebbeim, I think, have gotten older. But I think also because we recognized the danger of having Rebbeim that were more like NCSY advisors than Rebbeim. If you don't have that dugma yishit, if you don't have that role model to look up to, somebody that you go like, wow, that's the goal, that's the ambition, then when do you strive for greatness? So I would probably err on the side of more to the Rebbe side than the friendship side.
You know, I can't help but think about, you know, through the process of being a Rebbe and through the process of helping kids for so long, do you ever have it where you leave a conversation with a kid and you're like, maybe the advice that I gave him probably wasn't the best advice? Like, do you ever have that happen to you?
Yeah, of course. Of course, I've made that mistake many times. I heard from Rabbi Dr. Levitz, I think is Waxman's father-in-law, and a very well-known therapist. Years ago, he gave a shiur that I went to, and he said, we klap alchei ya'atznu ra. So he said, perhaps that means advice is bad. Not I gave bad advice, but advice is bad. And it was humbling to learn that because I always thought my Rebbeim, like they knew the answers to my questions. And the truth of the matter is nobody knows the answers to our questions, and our Rebbeim are not, again, going to take responsibility for the negative impact of the advice that they give. So I've tried to move away from giving advice. In fact, I'll share with you Rav Parnas Shlita, my Rebbe, Yishbi Zecher Refuah Shleima, when I had this big decision about making Aliyah or not. I had gone to different Rebbeim who had given me advice. And when I went to Rav Parnas, he said, this one I can't help you with because you have to own this decision. I could just help you formulate the problems. I mean, I could help you like understand what each side means. But after that, this is your life. You have to make this decision. And it was so frustrating to me because I was like, Rebbe, just tell me what to do. You know, like, and there is value, I think, in offering some wisdom of, you know, we're older, so we've learned a couple things along the way. But I think I learned from my Rebbe to try to stay away from giving advice, try to stay away from telling people what to do. Again, it depends. If it's an information deficit question, so then I think it's okay. It's like if a guy comes to me at the beginning of the year and goes, how do I, you know, find a bus that's going to take me to, you know, Yerushalayim? It's not helpful to go, how do you find a bus? Like, what would it look like for you to discover a bus? You know, like, that's not helpful. Just tell him, you know, go to Yeshiva, make a right, you know, run into the bus stop. But I think if a guy comes and he says, I'm not sure what to do, you know, I'm thinking about taking on an extra Seder. I'm thinking about breaking up with my girlfriend. I'm thinking about going out with this girl. You know, it's not helpful for me to say to him, like, yeah, go for it. Like, that's not, I don't think that's my place to do. So I'm trying to stay away from giving advice and trying more to pave the road with questions so that they can discover for themselves their own truth. If we don't do that, we rob them of the growth of decision-making. Decision-making builds muscle, right? So if we make their decision for them, not only might our advice be bad, but we've also robbed them of the opportunity to do the hard work.
You know, I can't help but think also with all this that we're talking about is that, and this is a very specific question, but there are definitely people, whether it's a friend that you're very close with or a Rebbe or some form of a mentor in your life where you get very vulnerable with, you open up a lot, and then that person does something and that relationship is gone. And then from there, that kind of scars you to be comfortable to, let's say, open up to somebody else in the future. So maybe, do you have any advice for, let's say, somebody that's listening to this that had a relationship, let's say, with somebody for years, and they were so close, open with about everything, and then that kind of scarred them essentially. To what's your advice to help them say, you know what, that's not the end of being able to trust somebody and open up and whatnot?
I have had that, and that it is very hard, and I can understand if somebody was hurt in that way. I would be able, I think, to be very empathetic to that. There was somebody in my life who betrayed my trust, somebody that I really like shared with them very vulnerably, and I don't think that they did the right thing. I think they're human. I think they're going through whatever they're going through. And the relationship is in a state right now, I would say, of disrepair. And a lot of it is my own work that I have to do to be able to like find forgiveness and empathy within myself, because I've also made mistakes. But I think I would very much be able to relate to a person who said that to me. There's a vulnerability trust paradox that exists, because in order to build trust with somebody, we need to be vulnerable. But in order to be vulnerable, we need to have trust, right? Safety first. So, like, think of it like dating, right? So on your first date, well, I guess everybody's story is different, but on your first date, if let's say you're just meeting the girl for the first time, right? So you're probably not going to like open up your closet and go like, here's all my stuff, right? It's not probably appropriate. And if somebody did that, that would be fascinating. Usually what we do is we test the waters, right? And then we see how they respond, right? If they can hold space for some of our imperfections, if we see that they're genuinely interested in what we're talking about, if we see kindness and compassion and empathy, right? And then also if they'll trust us by doing the same with us, right? So then there's this, you know, slow build up, right? And then there's always that one date, right? It's like, yeah, that was a crazy date. That was the date where we actually were ourselves with each other, right? So that's where it's like, oh, we can really trust each other. And in order for us to build a life with each other, we do need to be able to trust each other. I think it should be the same thing with a Rebbe. Not necessarily that the Rebbe is sharing back to the Talmud. That might actually be deeply inappropriate. But that the Talmud comes in on day one and tests the waters. What does it look like to be vulnerable with this Rebbe? You know, how do I feel when I walk out of the office, right? Take some time to let it sink in, right? Did that feel okay for me, right? Go back and do it again, right? And maybe it's a little bit more this time. And I think there's a process. The person you're speaking to has to be an honorable person. And that's where it gets tricky, because we're all human and we all make mistakes. And I would say one thing that Rebbeim, I think in a general sense, Rebbeim do this really well. It's a vault, right? Whatever is said in that office, unless, you know, it's the safety of the Talmud or somebody else's safety, right? Whatever is said in that office, it doesn't leave. Like, it doesn't go to your wife. It doesn't go anywhere, right? Unless it's absolutely necessary. Because that Talmud shared something very private. And he has to know, like, and he will, by the way, you could sense it, right? If you're a blabbermouth, like, that Talmud will sense that that's not okay. And so we hold things, and we have to, you know, we have to really make sure that the space where they're coming to be vulnerable is an honorable space. If, you know, a certain person that I know, and again, I think it comes probably from a difficult place in his life, but he has a tendency, and he's, I guess, in the world of the rabbinate, he has a tendency to talk about other people. And I'll never trust him, because I know what he said to me. And if I would trust him with something, I know that he's going to say it to somebody else. So inadvertently, he created a situation where I wanted to trust him. Like, I wanted him to be a person that I could go to and share with. But then when he started talking, I was like, I just can't, you know? So I do think that being a real honorable person in this regard is super important.
You know, you said a second ago about when a kid's in your office, that office is like a vault, right? If you had a kid that was sitting in front of you, that was new to yeshiva, that's not so used to opening up to Rebbe and being very vulnerable, and he looked you in the eye and he was like, Rabbi, convince me why I should open up and be vulnerable to somebody. What could that do for me in my life? What would you say?
I don't know if I would answer him. I think I would ask, help me understand the question. Like, what are you asking me? You want to play the game?
I don't know if I'm... in my opinion, I think what you could answer to that, per se, and this was another thing I want to talk about, was you've helped so many kids be vulnerable before, and that has resulted in so many amazing transitions in people's lives. So like, maybe this is kind of putting two questions together over here of like, what have you seen as benefits of kids that came into yeshiva in the beginning that really worked on themselves to be vulnerable in their life? And where has that kind of taken them today? If you have any examples.
Right. So I think those are two very different questions. I like both of them, but the,
you can answer whatever you want.
The first question I think is a good example of how when somebody comes presenting something overtly, we have a responsibility to try to understand what's happening covertly. Right? If a guy walks into my office and says, convince me to be vulnerable, right? Like, help me understand your question here, right? So then that's an opportunity for him to go, look, I want to trust you, right? But I've been burned by Rebbeim before, right? So he's not asking to be convinced to be vulnerable. He has to deal with a pain, right? And actually, even just by answering the question, perhaps he's been vulnerable enough so that you could gain his trust, right? So that would be, I think, the answer to the first question. The answer to the second question, at least for me, is vulnerability is the birthplace of connection. So, you know, you have a guy, he's in yeshiva, right? He wants to connect to Gemara. There's vulnerability there. He wants to work on his midos. There's the vulnerability of saying there are things that I have to work on, right? He moves on from yeshiva, and let's say he's in his next yeshiva, he's in college, right? Now you have the next level of vulnerability. How many guys, I'm sure you've had this, how many guys over the course of the years said, yeah, I didn't try in high school, right? But now I'm like, you know, I went to Israel and I'm much more mature, and now I'm about to go to college, but I have this inner negative belief about myself that I'm fundamentally incapable of learning, and I'm really afraid to, you know, go to SciSims or wherever it is that they're going next because I don't actually know that I'm capable of doing this, right? There's vulnerability there. Then they start dating, right? There's vulnerability there. And that's beautiful. They have children. They don't know what to do. There's vulnerability there. So if we want to connect to anything, the benefits of vulnerability is that it allows you to access self, and self is where connection happens. If you're armored up, right? And if you're holding people away because you're afraid of vulnerability, then how does someone marry you? Like, what version of yourself are they marrying? And what happens when they finally figure out who you really are, right? You could pretend to know what the Gemara is talking about, but then you actually haven't connected to Gemara. You don't actually know what's happening. So learning to be okay with the imperfection is, I think, fundamentally, like even in business, right? You want to be successful. You want to be able to connect to your clients. Vulnerability is at the core of all of those things. Certainly in Yiddishkeit, if we want to connect to Hashem, how, like, the point of connection is within, right? That's where we meet Hashem within ourselves. If we don't do that, if we're not vulnerable, we're not in self, how do we connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu?
It's very true. And back to kind of a point that you said before that I really want to touch on is, you know, there's two or many, not more than two, not there is more than two, excuse me, sides of the vulnerability aspect. You have a Rebbe, you have a friend, whatever it may be. And this question is more predicated on the peer-to-peer, not the Rebbe Talmud, of what's your advice for somebody that you have a close friend, they tell you something super, super important about themselves in a very vulnerable way, where you're like, okay, do I tell somebody else about this? Like, in whether it's a health thing or whatever it may be, like, what's your advice for somebody if that needs to be bumped up to, let's say, somebody, you know, that could really handle what they're going through?
Right. You know, it's interesting. I had a Talmud come to me recently to talk to me about this because somebody was going through something where he was concerned that they might be a danger to themselves or to others. So if you have any chashash about that whatsoever, I would err on the side of caution. And it doesn't mean you have to come in and say the person's name, but that's definitely the type of thing that you want to speak to a Rebbe about. If you're concerned that you don't know what to say, it's okay to come to speak to somebody and say, I don't really know what to say in this situation. You don't have to betray their trust. You don't have to say who it is. But there's nothing wrong with getting a piece of advice and saying, like, I don't know how to handle this. Even there's vulnerability in that, right? The Talmud who walks in and says, it seems to be beyond me. You know, I'll tell you the truth. A lot of times when guys walk in, I don't know what to say. The good news is that I don't have to know what to say, right? I'm not obligated to say anything. I'm just trying to, like, be a person that's there listening. So it actually relieves a lot of the pressure. And sometimes you can tell a Talmud, like, it seems like the guy you're talking to really just needs, like, some space to air something out. So you could just be a good friend and really listen, right, and not tell them how to do anything.
You know, I can't help but think also, based off of what you're saying, that, like, you know, yes, you have students that open up. It's easy for them. It's not for some, okay? And now, do you have any examples, per se, of a Talmud that post-yeshiva went through, you know, the stages of life, whether it was dating, marriage, and they struggled a lot with, you know, being vulnerable and whatnot, and to maybe their detriment, it did something to felt you know, affect them in a negative way in the future. Do you have any examples of that? And maybe could you touch on that for a second?
Where vulnerability hurt them?
Yeah. Or not vulnerability, not being vulnerable in a way that, let's say you're dating, for example, and you're struggling with being vulnerable to the girl that you're, or guy, whatever, whoever's listening to this in whatever capacity, to really opening up to that person. And then, you know, they get married, per se, as you use that example a second ago, of like, now I'm vulnerable and my spouse sees me in a way they never saw me before.
Right. Yeah, I think the one that's coming to mind, and again, I don't think this is unique. I don't think I'm saying anything about a specific person, but this concept comes to mind a lot. It really does, I think, matter the most in dating and marriage. You know, not just dating and marriage, but dating and marriage, I think, is where probably we first see it in a real way. The self, the godly soul, is a nuclear reactor of love and connection. And sometimes when people are struggling in dating, it's because they're not showing up in self. And so where is that connection? You know what I mean? It's like the date's not going well, right? And it's like, why isn't it going well? Well, who showed up to the date? This version of yourself showed up to the date, which is understandable because we're all going to put on some version of ourself in the beginning. But if we're not moving towards self, then you do see that sometimes dating can become that much harder. People are attracted to people that are open and vulnerable because they see, oh, there's a strength that you have. There's something safe about being with someone who's genuinely okay with not always being okay. And that connection, when it doesn't happen in dating, can be really painful. Or, like you mentioned, if they're not, let's say, they've managed to put on that version of themselves and they've managed to go to chuppah like that, okay, well, at some point you're living with somebody and you can only keep that version of yourself going for X amount of time, and nobody knows us like our spouses, right? So there's negative impact to that decision, because then it's like, wait a second, the guy that I dated, the girl that I dated, you seem to be somebody else right now. But then there is the process of learning, right? So then the person learns, like, oh, armoring up is not going to work very well in my relationship, right? Like, the marriage isn't working. And so, like, at some point, let's say it was a guy, right? Could go both ways, but let's say it was a guy who's armored up, and he's like, why won't she connect to me, right? At some point, he has to learn she can't connect to you because you're not participating in this relationship. The version of yourself is, but she's seeing past the version, and you're still showing up as that guy, so that connection isn't happening. I think, though, we see it in a million different ways. A person goes out, and they want to be successful in life. You know this, but all of business is about connection, right? If I'm not genuinely present, who's the person that I'm talking to? People get a sense, I'm about to use your service. They get a sense of, like, are you real? Are you just a salesman? Like, because I have to trust you because I'm about to invest in you. So I think it's everything. Certainly, when it comes to our Yiddishkeit, how long are we going to armor up and show up to davening saying the words without genuinely shedding a tear, you know? And I'm not talking about forcing it, but genuinely shedding that tear. It seems to me, I think I once heard this from Rav Soloveitchik, that Rav Soloveitchik said that back in Europe, they may not have known as much Torah as we know today, but they were very genuine and they knew how to, like, just show up to shul and cry about what was going on. I think we're in a much more armored up generation, so it's more difficult for us to access that. We know a lot more, but I'm not sure that we're as deeply connected to ourselves.
You know, one point I want to touch on that's kind of niche, I guess you could say, in this context, but, you know, I'm sure you have a lot of telemedium you advise or give advice when it comes to dating and whatnot, guys and girls on each side, because I know you speak in seminaries. There might not be a general answer for this one, but when it comes to dating, right, sometimes, as you mentioned earlier, that you sit in front of somebody that some guy set you up with, some girl set you up with, and you're like, I really don't know this person, and you're starting from scratch, right? So like, specifically when it comes to dating, like, what's your advice to somebody of like, okay, now is a time in your dating where it's like more okay to be vulnerable and open up? Like, I'm sure it's a hard balance, but what would you say your advice that you probably give to people are?
Yeah. I'll tell you what I don't like. I don't like rebbeim that give like, you know, the checklist of like, on a first date you do this, on a second date you do this, on the fifth date you should be holding by here, on the eighth date you should be holding by there. Relationships unfold in their own time and in their own space, and every relationship is going to develop differently. So it seems to me to be unwise to give some sort of advice that you're supposed to be holding here at this point. I'm not sure. I'm not sure why anyone thinks that makes any sense. I don't personally. I know that I've gotten those phone calls before of like, I feel like we should be holding here. And it's like, should you be? Like, I don't know. Maybe she's slower to open up. Maybe you're slower to open up. Maybe it just needs more runway. I don't know. So I'm definitely not a fan of like the checklist. I'll tell you what I am a fan though of. I believe that we all know the answers to our questions inside of ourselves. And people have a very strong sense of intuition when they're in self. And so you meet people sometimes, and some people, they appear to be more confident. It's not confidence. It's they're in touch with themselves, so the knowledge that they have within of what I need to do next is very present. Mm-hmm. So it's like you look at it and go, oh, they're confident. Confident could be arrogant, right? When you're deeply in touch with yourself, you have that intuition. So if you're on a date with someone, right, and you're in self, you'll have that natural intuition, that clarity of like, it's a good time to put this out there, right? And if you're not in self and you're operating from fear, you're not going to have that intuition, and then you're going to end up following some checklist. You know, I'll tell you one thing. I think you're exceptionally vulnerable. No, I'm being serious. It's not easy to do what you're doing, right? You put yourself out there. You made this Israel Gap Year thing, right? You started, you know, with this podcast. You're reaching out. I don't know if you know everyone that you're reaching out to or if you've interacted with everyone you're reaching out to, but you're certainly...
Not everybody.
Right. You're reaching out to people. You're asking them to do something. There's a lot of courage that's here, right? And even though you're the one asking the questions, we both know that there are going to be people that are watching this that are going to be judging both of us, right? And one of your guests, I won't tell you which one, he once told me that when he gives a Musar Shmuz in his yeshiva, he could see the Talmidim like judging how he's doing while he's giving the shmooze. And he, like he said, he wants to say to them, you know, if you could just like lower your judgmentalism for 1 second and actually take in the musar, it might be helpful. But it's natural for people to judge, right? So that's why we do that. So I bet you people are going to be looking at this podcast and they're going to be judging both of us, right? Did you ask the right questions? Did I give answers that made any sense to people? There's a lot of vulnerability in the room right now. And I think if we start to recognize how much vulnerability is actually happening everywhere we go, I think we start to attune ourselves to that and go like, oh, look, I've been courageous before. Like, I'm betting you didn't start off with this podcast being courageous. I'm betting that from the time you were younger, right, there was vulnerability and you had access to courage, and that, you know, certain wins that you got in your life brought you to this moment. All of us have that.
True. Wow. You know, I couldn't agree more with what you said. And just one question that I like to end off with, and this is, it could be directed towards any age of person, or it could be a general call. If you had one, I guess, piece of advice for anybody that's listening to this that was like, take this message, put it in a bottle and keep it in your pocket wherever you go for the rest of your life, what would that message be?
That's a great one. Yeah, I'm gonna rip off somebody else's answer because I think it's really important. And maybe it's like in two parts. Many years ago, somebody who's significantly older than me said this, and it really struck me. He said, I wish I wouldn't have spent so much time when I was younger thinking about what other people thought. And that really struck me because when I met him, he was this really courageous, really open, really vulnerable person. It never occurred to me that he was like, you know, like me, I guess, right. You know, that I cared so much when I was younger about what other people thought. But I think we all do. And I would really want to say to somebody who's listening to this that it doesn't really matter what anyone else thinks of you. Like, not truly. You have to live with yourself. You have to live with integrity. You're the one that has to look in the mirror every day. And it's okay to know that you're going to be great at two or three things and you'll be good at some other things, and some things you're just going to stink at. And that's okay, because we each have our own strengths and weaknesses. Just do what you do, and if you do that and you play to your strengths, I think ultimately you'll find great meaning in life.
Could not agree more, and I think the conversation that we've had for the past hour was just very enjoyable for me, and I didn't really look at this so much, and just goes to show, you know, how awesome this was for me.
You're really good at this. Thank you very much. I'm being serious. This is not. I've done this before. You're really good at it.
I appreciate it. So thank you so much for coming, and hope to have you back soon.
Absolutely. Looking forward.
Thank you guys so much for watching today's episode with Rav Mordechai Berger. I hope you guys really enjoyed. And if you do, please click that like button and subscribe on YouTube so that you can get notified every single week when I put out a new episode with a new guest. Thank you so much for watching. Looking forward to seeing you guys next week, and we'll see you soon.